Audio Bookshelf presents Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin and read by Ray Childs. Rest at pale evening, a tall, slim tree. Night coming tenderly, black like me. From Dream Variation, Langston Hughes. October 28th, 1959. For years, the idea had haunted me, and that night it returned more insistently than ever. If a white man became a Negro in the Deep South, what adjustments would he have to make? What is it like to experience discrimination based on skin color, something over which one has no control? This speculation was sparked again by a report that lay on my desk in the old barn that served as my office. The report mentioned the rise in suicide tendency among Southern Negroes. This did not mean that they killed themselves, but rather that they had reached a stage where they simply no longer cared whether they lived or died. It was that bad, then, despite the white Southern legislators who insisted that they had a wonderfully harmonious relationship with Negroes. I lingered on in my office at my parents' Mansfield, Texas farm. My wife and children slept in our home 5 miles away. I sat there, surrounded by the smells of autumn coming through my open window, unable to leave, unable to sleep. How else, except by becoming a Negro, could a white man hope to learn the truth? Though we lived side by side throughout the South, communication between the two races had simply ceased to exist. Neither really knew what went on with those of the other race. The Southern Negro will not tell the white man the truth. He long ago learned that if he speaks a truth unpleasing to the white will make life miserable for him. The only way I could see to bridge the gap between us was to become a Negro. I decided I would do this. I prepared to walk into a life that appeared suddenly mysterious and frightening. With my decision to become a Negro, I realized that I, a specialist in race issues, really knew nothing of the Negro's real problem. October 29th, 1959. I drove into Fort Worth in the afternoon to discuss the project with my old friend, George Levitan. He is the owner of Sepia, an internationally distributed Negro magazine with a format similar to that of Look. A large, middle-aged man, he long ago won my admiration by offering equal job opportunities to members of any race, choosing according to their qualifications and future potentialities. With an on-the-job training program, he has made Sepia a model, edited, printed, and distributed from the million-dollar Fort Worth plant. It was a beautiful autumn day. I drove to his house, arriving there in mid-afternoon. His door was always open, so I walked in and called him. An affectionate man, he embraced me, offered me coffee, and had me take a seat. Through the glass doors of his den, I looked out to see a few dead leaves floating on the water of his swimming pool. He listened, his cheek buried in his fist as I explained the project.
"It's a crazy idea," he said. "You'll get yourself killed fooling around down there."
But he could not hide his enthusiasm. I told him the South's racial situation was a blot on the whole country, and especially reflected against us overseas, and that the best way to find out if we had second-class citizens and what their plight was would be to become one of them.
"But it'll be terrible," he said. "You'll be making yourself the target of the most ignorant rabble in the country. If they ever caught you, they'd be sure to make an example of you."
He gazed out the window, his face puffed with concentration.
"But you know, it is a great idea. I can see right now you're going through with it. So what can I do to help?
Pay the tab, and I'll give Sepia some articles, or let you use some chapters from the book I'll write. He agreed, but suggested that before I made final plans, I discuss it with Mrs. Adele Jackson, Sepia's editorial director. Both of us have a high regard for this extraordinary woman's opinions. She rose from a secretarial position to become one of the country's distinguished editors. After leaving Mr. Levitan, I called on her. At first, she thought the idea was impossible. "You don't know what you'll be getting into, John," she said. She felt that when my book was published, I would be the butt of resentment from all the hate groups, that they would stop at nothing to discredit me, and that many decent whites would be afraid to show me courtesies when others might be watching. And, too, there are the deeper currents among even well-intentioned Southerners, currents that make the idea of a white man's assuming non-white identity a somewhat repulsive step down. And other currents that say, "Don't stir up anything. Let's try to keep things peaceful." And then I went home and told my wife. After she recovered from her astonishment, she unhesitatingly agreed that if I felt I must do this thing, then I must. She offered as her part of the project her willingness to lead, with our three children, the unsatisfactory family life of a household deprived of husband and father. I returned at night to my barn office. Outside my open window, frogs and crickets made the silence more profound. A chill breeze rustled dead leaves in the woods. It carried an odor of fresh-turned dirt, drawing my attention to the fields where the tractor had only a few hours ago stopped plowing the earth. I sensed the radiance of it in the stillness, sensed the earthworms that burrowed back into the depths of the furrows, sensed the animals that wandered in the woods in search of nocturnal rut or food. I felt the beginning loneliness, the terrible dread of what I had decided to do. October 30th, 1959. Lunched with Mrs. Jackson, Mr. Levitan, and three FBI men from the Dallas office. Though I knew my project was outside their jurisdiction and that they could not support it in any way, I wanted them to know about it in advance. We discussed it in considerable detail. I decided not to change my name or identity. I would merely change my pigmentation and allow people to draw their own conclusions. If asked who I was or what I was doing, I would answer truthfully. "Do you suppose they'll treat me as John Howard Griffin, regardless of my color? Or will they treat me as some nameless Negro, even though I am still the same man?" I asked.
"You're not serious," one of them said. "They're not going to ask you any questions. As soon as they see you, you'll be a Negro, and that's all they'll ever want to know about you."
November 1st, 1959, New Orleans, Louisiana. Arrived by plane as night set in. I checked my bags at the Hotel Monteleone in the French Quarter and began walking. Strange experience. When I was blind, I came here and learned cane walking in the French Quarter. Now, the most intense excitement filled me as I saw the places I visited while blind. I walked miles, trying to locate everything by sight that I once knew only by smell and sound. The streets were full of sightseers. I wandered among them, entranced by the narrow streets, the iron grill balconies, the green plants and vines glimpsed in lighted flagstone courtyards. Every view was magical, whether it was a deserted lamplit street corner or the neon hubbub of Royal Street. I walked past garish bars where hawkers urged me in to see the gorgeous girls do their hip-shaking, and they left the doors open sufficiently to show dim, smoke-blue interiors crossed by long rays of pink spotlights that turned the semi-nude girls' flesh rose. I strolled on. Jazz blared from the bars. Odors of old stone and Creole cooking and coffee filled the streets. At Broussard's, I had supper in a superb courtyard under the stars. Huîtres variées, green salad, white wine and coffee, the same meal I had there in past years. I saw everything. The lanterns, the trees, the candlelit tables, the little fountain, as though I were looking through a fine camera lens. Surrounded by elegant waiters, elegant people, and elegant food, I thought of the other parts of town where I would live in the days to come. Was there a place in New Orleans where a Negro could buy wheat varier? At 10, I finished dinner and went to telephone an old friend who lives in New Orleans. He insisted I stay at his house, and I was relieved, for I foresaw all sorts of difficulties staying in a hotel while I turned into a Negro. November 2, 1959. In the morning, I called the Medical Information Service and asked for the names of some prominent dermatologists. They gave me three names. The first one I called gave me an appointment immediately, so I took the streetcar to his office and explained my needs. He had had no experience with such a request, but was willing enough to aid me in my project. After taking my case history, he asked me to wait while he consulted with some of his colleagues by phone as to the best method of darkening my skin. After some time, he stepped back into the room and said they had all agreed we should attempt it with a medication taken orally, followed by exposure to ultraviolet rays. He explained they used it on victims of vitiligo, a disease that causes white spots to appear in the face and body. Until this medication was discovered, the victims of this disease had had to wear pancake makeup when they went out in public. It could be dangerous to use, however. It usually took from 6 weeks to 3 months to darken the skin pigmentation. I told him I could not spare that much time, and we decided to try accelerated treatments with constant blood tests to see how my system tolerated the medication. I got the prescription filled, returned to the house, and took the tablets. 2 hours later, I exposed my entire body to ultraviolet rays from a sun lamp. My host remained away from the house most of the time. I told him I was on an assignment that I could not discuss, and that he should not be surprised if I simply disappeared without saying goodbye. I knew that he had no prejudices, but I nevertheless did not want to involve him in any way, since reprisals might be taken against him by bigots or by his associates, who might resent his role as my host once my story became known. He gave me a key to his house, and we agreed to maintain our different schedules without worrying about the usual host-guest relationship. After supper, I took the trolley into town and walked through some of the Negro sections in the South Rampart Dryad Street sections. They are mostly poor sections with cafes, bars, and businesses of all sorts alongside cluttered residences. I searched for an opening, a way to enter the world of the Negro, some contact, perhaps. As yet, it was a blank to me. My greatest preoccupation was that moment of transition when I would pass over. Where and how would I do it? To get from the white world into the Negro world is a complex matter. I looked for the chink in the wall through which I might pass unobserved. November 6th. For the past 4 days, I had spent my time at the doctor's or closed up in my room with cotton pads over my eyes and the sun lamp turned on me. They had made blood tests twice and found no indication of damage to the liver. But the medication produced lassitude, and I felt constantly on the verge of nausea. The doctor, well disposed, gave me many warnings about the dangers of this project insofar as my contact with Negroes was concerned. Now that he had had time to think, he was beginning to doubt the wisdom of this course, or perhaps he felt strongly his responsibility. In any event, he warned me that I must have some contact in each major city so my family could check on my safety from time to time.
"I believe in the brotherhood of man," he said. "I respect the race. But I can never forget when I was an intern and had to go down on South Rampart Street to patch them up. Three or four would be sitting in a bar or at a friend's house. They were apparently friends 1 minute, and then something would come up and one would get slashed up with a knife. We're willing enough to go all the way for them, but we've got this problem. How can you render the duties of justice to men when you're afraid they'll be so unaware of justice they may destroy you, especially since their attitude toward their own race is a destructive one? He said this with real sadness. I told him my contacts indicated that Negroes themselves were aware of this dilemma, and they were making strong efforts to unify the race, to condemn among themselves any tactic or any violence or injustice that would reflect against the race as a whole. I'm glad to hear that, he said, obviously unconvinced. He also told me things that Negroes had told him, that the lighter the skin, the more trustworthy the Negro. I was astonished to see an intelligent man fall for this cliché, and equally astonished that Negroes would advance it. For in effect, it placed the dark Negro in an inferior position and fed the racist idea of judging a man by his color. When not lying under the lamp, I walked the streets of New Orleans to orient myself. Each day I stopped at a sidewalk shoeshine stand near the French Market. The shine boy was an elderly man, large, keenly intelligent, and a good talker. He had lost a leg during World War I. He showed none of the obsequiousness of the Southern Negro, but was polite and easy to know. Not that I had any illusions that I knew him, for he was too astute to allow any white man that privilege. I told him I was a writer, touring the Deep South to study living conditions, civil rights, etc., but I did not tell him I would do this as a Negro. Finally, we exchanged names. He was called Sterling Williams. I decided he might be the contact for my entry into the Negro community. November 7th. I had my last visit with the doctor in the morning. The treatment had not worked as rapidly or completely as we had hoped, but I had a dark undercoating of pigment which I could touch up perfectly with stain. We decided I must shave my head, since I had no curl. The dosage was established, and the darkness would increase as time passed. From there, I was on my own. The doctor showed much doubt, and perhaps regret, that he had ever cooperated with me in this transformation. Again, he gave me many firm warnings and told me to get in touch with him any time of the day or night if I got into trouble. As I left his office, he shook my hand and said gravely, "Now you go into oblivion." A cold spell had hit New Orleans, so that lying under the lamp that day was a comfortable experience. I decided to shave my head that evening and begin my journey. In the afternoon, my host looked at me with friendly alarm. "I don't know what you're up to," he said, "but I'm worried." I told him not to be, and suggested I would probably leave sometime that night. He said he had a meeting, but would cancel it. I asked him not to. "I don't want you here when I go," I said.
"What are you going to do, be a Puerto Rican or something?" he asked.
"Something like that," I said. "There may be ramifications. I'd rather you didn't know anything about it. I don't want you involved." He left around 5. I fixed myself a bite of supper and drank many cups of coffee, putting off the moment when I would shave my head, grind in the stain, and walk out into the New Orleans night as a Negro. I telephoned home, but no one answered. My nerves simmered with dread. Finally, I began to cut my hair and shave my head. It took hours and many razor blades before my pate felt smooth to my hand. The house settled into silence around me. Occasionally, I heard the trolley car rattle past as the night grew late. I applied coat after coat of stain, wiping each coat off. Then I showered to wash off all the excess. I did not look into the mirror until I finished dressing and had packed my duffel bags. Turning off all the lights, I went into the bathroom and closed the door. I stood in the darkness before the mirror, my hand on the light switch.
I forced myself to flick it on. In the flood of light against white tile, the face and shoulders of a stranger, a fierce, bald, very dark Negro, glared at me from the glass. He in no way resembled me. The transformation was total and shocking. I had expected to see myself disguised, but this was something else. I was imprisoned in the flesh of an utter stranger, an unsympathetic one with whom I felt no kinship. All traces of the John Griffin I had been were wiped from existence. Even the senses underwent a change so profound it filled me with distress. I looked into the mirror and saw reflected nothing of the white John Griffin's past. No, the reflections led back to Africa, back to the shanty and the ghetto, back to the fruitless struggles against the mark of blackness. Suddenly, almost with no mental preparation, no advance hint, it became clear and permeated my whole being. My inclination was to fight against it. I had gone too far. I knew now that there is no such thing as a disguised white man when the black won't rub off. The black man is wholly a Negro, regardless of what he once may have been. I was a newly created Negro who must go out that door and live in a world unfamiliar to me. The completeness of this transformation appalled me. It was unlike anything I had imagined. I became two men, the observing one and the one who panicked, who felt Negroid even into the depths of his entrails. I felt the beginnings of great loneliness, not because I was a Negro, but because the man I had been, the self I knew, was hidden in the flesh of another. If I returned home to my wife and children, they would not know me. They would open the door and stare blankly at me. My children would want to know, who is this large, bald Negro? If I walked up to friends, I knew I would see no flicker of recognition in their eyes. I had tampered with the mystery of existence, and I had lost the sense of my own being. This is what devastated me. The Griffin that was had become invisible. The worst of it was that I could feel no companionship with this new person. I did not like the way he looked. Perhaps, I thought, this was only the shock of a first reaction. But the thing was done, and there was no possibility of turning back. For a few weeks, I must be this aging, bald Negro. I must walk through a land hostile to my color, hostile to my skin. How did one start? The night lay out there, waiting. 1,000 questions presented themselves. The strangeness of my situation struck me anew. I was a man born old at midnight into a new life. How does such a man act? Where does he go to find food, water, a bed? The phone rang, and I felt my nerves convulse. I answered and told the caller my host was out for the evening. Again, the strangeness, the secret awareness that the person on the other end did not know he talked with a Negro. Downstairs, I heard the soft chiming of the old clock. I knew it was midnight, though I did not count. It was time to go. With enormous self-consciousness, I stepped from the house into the darkness. No one was in sight. I walked to the corner and stood under a street lamp, waiting for the trolley. I heard footsteps. From the shadows, the figure of a white man emerged. He came and stood beside me. It was all new. Should I nod and say good evening, or simply ignore him? He stared intently at me. I stood like a statue, wondering if he would speak, would question me. Though the night was cold, sweat dampened my body. This was also new. It was the first time this adult Negro had ever perspired. I thought it vaguely illuminating that the Negro Griffin's sweat felt exactly the same to his body as the white Griffin's. As I had suspected they would be, my discoveries were naive ones, like those of a child. The streetcar, with pale light pouring from its windows, rumbled to a stop. I remembered to let the white man on first. He paid his fare and walked to an empty seat, ignoring me. I felt my first triumph. He had not questioned me. The ticket taker on the streetcar nodded affably when I paid my fare. Though streetcars are not segregated in New Orleans, I took a seat near the back. Negroes there glanced at me without the slightest suspicion or interest. I began to feel more confident. I asked one of them where I could find a good hotel. He said the butler on Rampart Street was as good as any, and told me what bus to take from downtown. I got off and began walking along Canal Street in the heart of town, carrying one small duffel bag in each hand. I passed the same taverns and amusement places where the hawkers had solicited me on previous evenings. They were busy, urging white men to come in and see the girls. The same smells of smoke and liquor and dampness poured out through half-open doors. Tonight, they did not solicit me. Tonight, they looked at me, but did not see me. I went into a drugstore that I had patronized every day since my arrival. I walked to the cigarette counter, where the same girl I had talked with every day waited on me. "Package of picayunes, please," I said in response to her blank look. She handed them to me, took my bill, and gave me change with no sign of recognition, none of the banter of previous days. Again, my reaction was that of a child. I was aware that the street smells and the drugstore odors of perfume and arnica were exactly the same to the Negro as they had been to the white. Only this time I could not go to the soda fountain and order a limeade or ask for a glass of water. I caught the bus to South Rampart Street. Except for the taverns, the street was deserted when I arrived at the Butler Hotel. A man behind the counter was making a barbecue sandwich for a woman customer. He said he'd find me a room as soon as he finished. I took a seat at one of the tables and waited. A large, pleasant-faced Negro walked in and sat at the counter. He grinned at me and said, "Man, you really got your top shaved, didn't you?"
"Yeah, doesn't it look all right?"
"Man, it's slick. Makes you look real good." He said he understood the gals were really going for bald-headed men. "They say that's a sure sign of being high-sexed."
I let him think I'd shaved my head for that reason. We talked easily. I asked him if this was the best hotel in the area. He said the Sunset Hotel down the street might be a little better. I picked up my bags and walked toward the door.
"See you around, Slick," he called after me.
An orange neon sign guided me to the Sunset Hotel, which is located next to a bar. The drab little lobby was empty. I waited a moment at the desk and then rang a call bell. A man, obviously awakened from sleep, came down the hall in his undershirt, buttoning on trousers. He said I would have to pay in advance and that he didn't allow men to take girls up to the rooms. I paid the $2.85, and he led me up narrow, creaking stairs to the second floor. I stood behind him as he opened the door to my room and saw over his shoulder the desolate, windowless cubicle. I almost backed out, but realized I could probably find nothing better. We entered, and I saw that the room was clean.
"The bathroom's down the hall," he said.
I locked the door after him and sat down on the bed to the loud twang of springs. A deep gloom spread through me, heightened by noise of talk, laughter, and jukebox jazz from the bar downstairs. My room was scarcely larger than the double bed. An open transom above the door into the hall provided the only ventilation. The air, mingled with that of other rooms, was not fresh. In addition to the bed, I had a tiny gas stove and a broken-down bedstand. On it were two thin hand towels, a half bar of ivory soap. It was past one now. The light was so feeble I could hardly see to write. With no windows, I felt boxed in, suffocating. I turned off my light and tried to sleep, but the noise was too much. Light through the open transom fell on the ceiling fan, casting distorted shadows of the four motionless blades against the opposite wall. A dog barked nearby, and his bark grew louder as another tune from the jukebox blasted up through my linoleum floor. I could not shake the almost desperate sadness all this evoked, and I marveled that sounds could so degrade the spirit. I slipped into my pants and walked barefoot down the narrow, dim-lit hall to the door with a crudely lettered sign reading Men. When I stepped in, the hollow roar of water beating against the wall of a metal shower filled the room, along with an odor of cold sweat and soap. One man was in the shower. Another, a large, black-skinned man, sat naked on the floor, awaiting his turn at the shower. He leaned back against the wall with his legs stretched out in front of him. Despite his state of undress, he had an air of dignity. Our eyes met, and he nodded his polite greeting.
"It's getting cold, isn't it?" he said.
"It sure is."
"You talking to me?"
the man in the shower called out above the thrumming.
"No, there's another gentleman here." "I won't be much longer."
"Take your time. He don't want a shower." I noted the bathroom was clean, though the fixtures were antique and rust-stained.
"Have you got a stove in your room?"
the man on the floor asked. We looked at one another, and there was kindness in his search for conversation. "Yes, but I haven't turned it on."
"You didn't want to take a shower, did you?"
he asked. "No, it's too cold. You must be freezing on that bare floor with no clothes on." His brown eyes lost some of their gravity.
"It's been so hot here recently. Feels kind of good to be cold."
I stepped over to the corner wash basin to rinse my hands.
"You can't use that,"
he said quickly.
"That water will run out on the floor."
I looked beneath, as he indicated, and saw it had no drain pipe. He reached beside him and flicked back the wet canvas shower curtain.
"Hey, how about stepping back and letting this gentleman wash his hands?"
"That's all right. I can wait," I said.
"Go ahead,"
he nodded.
"Sure, come on,"
the man in the shower said. He turned the water down to a dribble. In the shower's obscurity, all I could see was a black shadow and gleaming white teeth. I stepped over the other's outstretched legs and washed quickly, using the soap the man in the shower thrust into my hands. When I had finished, I thanked him.
"That's all right. Glad to do it,"
he said, turning the water on full strength again. The man on the floor handed up his towel for me to dry my hands. Under the dim light in the tiny room without windows, I realized I was having my first prolonged contact as a Negro with other Negroes. Its drama lay in its lack of drama, in its quietness, in the courtesies we felt impelled to extend to one another. I wondered if the world outside was so bad for us that we had to counter it among ourselves by salving one another with kindness. "Do you want a cigarette?" I asked.
"Please, sir, I believe I will."
He leaned his heavy body forward to accept one. His black flesh picked up dull highlights from the bare globe overhead. I fished in my pants pocket for matches and lighted our cigarettes. We talked local politics. I told him I was new in town and knew nothing about them. He refrained from asking questions, but explained that Mayor Morrison had a good reputation for fairness, and the Negroes were hoping he would get elected governor. I sensed the conversation made little difference, that for a few moments we were safe from the world and were loath to break the communication and go back to our rooms. It gave us warmth and pleasure, though we talked formally and showed one another great respect. Not once did he ask my name or where I came from. When the man in the shower finished and stepped out dripping, the larger man hoisted himself up from the floor, tossed his cigarette into the toilet bowl, and got into the shower. I told them good night and returned to my room, less lonely, and warmed by the brief contact with others like me, who felt the need to be reassured that an eye could show something besides suspicion or hate. November 8th. The dark room. The streak of pale light through the transom. I woke to it several times, thinking it a long night. Then it occurred to me that there were no windows, that it might well be day outside. I dressed, took my bags, and walked down the steps. The sun glared brilliantly on Rampart Street. Traffic pushed past the lobby window.
"You coming back tonight, Mr. Griffin?"
the man at the desk asked pleasantly. "I'm not sure."
"You can leave your bags here if you wish."
"Thanks, I need what's in them," I said.
"Did you sleep all right?"
"Yes, fine. What time is it?"
"No past 11:30.
"Damn, I think I did sleep." The world looked blurred through the window, and I waited for my eyes to accustom themselves to sunlight. I wondered what I should do, where I should go. I had a few changes of shirts, handkerchiefs, and underwear in my duffel, about $200 in traveler's checks and $20 in cash. In addition, I had my medicines and a month's supply of the pigmentation capsules. I stepped out into the street and began to walk in search of food. No one noticed me. The street was full of Negroes. I ambled along, looking in store windows. White proprietors who cater exclusively to Negro trade stood in doorways and solicited us.
"Step right in. Nice special on shoes today. Come in just a minute. No obligation. Like to show you these new hats."
Their voices wheedled and they smiled in counterfeit. It was the ghetto. I had seen them before from the high altitude of one who could look down in pity. Now I belonged here, and the view was different. A first glance told it all. Here it was pennies and clutter and spittle on the curb. Here people walked fast to juggle the dimes, to make a deal, to find cheap liver or a tomato that was overripe. Here was the indefinable stink of despair. Here modesty was the luxury. People struggled for it. I saw it as I passed, looking for food. A young, slick-haired man screamed loud obscenities to an older woman on the sidewalk. She laughed and threw them back in his face. They raged. Others passed them, hearing, looking down, pursing lips, struggling not to notice. Here, sensuality was escape, proof of manhood for people who could prove it no other way. Here at noon, jazz blared from jukeboxes and dark holes issued forth the cool odors of beer, wine, and flesh into the sunlight. Here, hips drew the eye and flirted with the eye and caused the eye to lust or laugh. It was better to look at hips than at the ghetto. Here I saw a young man who carried in his body the substance of the saint, stagger, glass-eyed, unconscious from the dark hole, sit down on the curb, and vomit between his feet.
"Man, he can't hold his at all," someone said.
I saw the sun caught in sweaty black wrinkles at the back of his neck as his head flopped forward. "You okay?" I asked, bending over him. He nodded listlessly.
"Ah, shit, he just gassed," someone said. "He's okay."
An odor of Creole cooking led me to a cafe at the corner. It was a small but cheerful room, painted baby blue. Tables were set with red-checked cloths. Except for a man at the counter, who nodded as I entered, I was the only customer. A pleasant young Negro woman took my order and fixed my breakfast. Eggs, grits, bread, and coffee, 49 cents. No butter, and no napkin. The man at the counter turned toward me and smiled, as though he wanted to talk.
I had made it a rule to talk as little as possible at first. He noticed my bags and asked me if I were here looking for work. I told him I was, and asked him if there were any better part of town where I could get a room.
"Ain't this awful?" he grimaced, coming over to my table.
"You live down here?"
"Yeah."
He closed his eyes wearily. Light from the door struck gray in his temples.
"The Y over on Dryads is about the best place. It's clean, and has a nice bunch of fellows there," he said.
He asked me what kind of work I did, and I told him I was a writer. He told me that he often took the bus into the better parts of town where the whites lived.
"Just to get away from this place. I just walk the streets and look at the houses.
Anything.
Just to get somewhere where it's decent. To get a smell of clean air."
"I know," I sympathized. I invited him to have a cup of coffee. He told me about the town, places where I might go to find jobs.
"Is there a Catholic church around here?" I asked after a while.
"Yeah, just a couple of blocks over on Dryads."
"Where's the nearest restroom?" I asked.
"Well, man, now just what do you want to do? Piss or pray?" he chuckled.
Though we talked quietly, the waitress heard, and her high chortle was quickly muffled in the kitchen.
"I guess it doesn't hurt for a man to do both once in a while," I said.
"You're so right," he laughed, shaking his head from side to side. "You're so right, sir. Lordy, lordy. If you stick around this town, you find out you're going to end up doing most of your praying for a place to piss. It's not easy, I'm telling you. You can go in some of the stores around here, but you've almost got to buy something before you can ask them to let you use a toilet. Some of the taverns got places. You can go over to the train station or the bus station, places like that. You just have to locate them. And there's not many of them for us. Best thing's just to stick close to home. Otherwise, sometimes you find you got to walk halfway across town to find a place."
When I left him, I caught the bus into town, choosing a seat halfway to the rear. As we neared Canal, the car began to fill with whites. Unless they could find a place to themselves or beside another white, they stood in the aisle. A middle-aged woman with stringy gray hair stood near my seat. She wore a clean but faded print house dress that was hoisted to one side as she clung to an overhead pendant support. Her face looked tired, and I felt uncomfortable. As she staggered with the bus's movement, my lack of gallantry tormented me. I half rose from my seat to give it to her, but Negroes behind me frowned disapproval. I realized I was going against the race, and the subtle tug of war became instantly clear. If the whites would not sit with us, let them stand. When they became tired enough or uncomfortable enough, they would eventually take seats beside us and soon see that it was not so poisonous after all. But to give them your seat was to let them win. I slumped back under the intensity of their stares. But my movement had attracted the white woman's attention. For an instant our eyes met. I felt sympathy for her and thought I detected sympathy in her glance. The exchange blurred the barriers of race, so new to me, long enough for me to smile and vaguely indicate the empty seat beside me, letting her know she was welcome to accept it. Her blue eyes, so pale before, sharpened, and she spat out,
"What are you looking at me like that for?"
I felt myself flush. Other white passengers craned to look at me. The silent onrush of hostility frightened me. "I'm sorry," I said, staring at my knees. "I'm not from here." The pattern of her skirt turned abruptly as she faced the front.
"They're getting sassier every day," she said loudly.
Another woman agreed, and the two fell into conversation. My flesh prickled with shame, for I knew the Negroes rightly resented me for attracting such unfavorable attention. I sat the way I had seen them do, sphinx-like, pretending unawareness. Gradually people lost interest. Hostility drained to boredom. The poor woman chattered on, reluctant, apparently, to lose the spotlight. I learned a strange thing, that in a jumble of unintelligible talk, the word nigger leaps out with electric clarity. You always hear it, and always it stings. And always it casts the person using it into a category of brute ignorance. I thought with some amusement that if these two women only knew what they were revealing about themselves to every Negro on that bus, they would have been outraged. I left the bus on Canal Street. Other Negroes aboard eyed me not with anger, as I had expected, but rather with astonishment that any black man could be so stupid. For an hour I roamed aimlessly through streets at the edge of the French Quarter. Always crowds, and always the sun. On Durbany Street I had coffee in a small Negro café called the Two Sisters Restaurant. A large poster on the wall caught my attention. "Desegregate the buses with this 7-point program. 1. Pray for guidance. 2. Be courteous and friendly. 3. Be neat and clean. 4. Avoid loud talk. 5. Do not argue. 6. Report incidents immediately. 7. Overcome evil with good. Sponsored by Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance. Reverend A. L. Davis, President. Reverend J. E. Poindexter, Secretary. I walked to the same shoe shine stand in the French Quarter that I had been visiting as a white man. My friend Sterling Williams sat on an empty box on the sidewalk. He looked up without a hint of recognition.
"Shine?"
"I believe so," I said, and climbed up on the stand. He hoisted his heavy body on his crutch and hobbled over to begin the work. I wore shoes of an unusual cut. He had shined them many times, and I felt he should certainly recognize them.
"Well, it's another fine day," he said.
"Sure is." I felt brisk strokes of his brush across the toe of my shoe.
"You're new in town, aren't you?"
I looked down on the back of his head. Gray hair kinked below the rim of a sea captain cap of black canvas. "Yeah, just been here a few days," I said.
"I thought I hadn't seen you around the quarter before," he said pleasantly. "You'll find New Orleans a nice place."
"Seems pretty nice. The people are polite."
"Oh, sure. If a man goes about his business and doesn't pay any attention to them, they won't bother you. I don't mean any bowing or scraping. Just, you know, show you got some dignity."
He raised his glance to my face and smiled wisely. "I see what you mean," I said. He had almost finished shining the shoes before I asked, "Is there something familiar about these shoes?"
"Yeah, I've been shining some for a white man."
"A fellow named Griffin?"
"Yeah."
He straightened up.
"Do you know him?"
"I am him." He stared, dumbfounded. I reminded him of various subjects we had discussed on former visits. Finally convinced, he slapped my leg with glee and lowered his head. His shoulders shook with laughter.
"Well, I'm truly a son of a bitch. How did you ever?"
I explained briefly. His heavy face shone with delight at what I had done, and delight that I should confide it to him. He promised perfect discretion, and enthusiastically began coaching me, but in a guarded voice, glancing always about to make sure no one could overhear. I asked him if I could stay and help him shine shoes for a few days. He said the stand really belonged to his partner, who was out trying to locate some peanuts to sell to the winos of the quarter. We'd have to ask him, but he was sure it would be all right.
"But you're way too well-dressed for a shine, boy."
We sat on boxes beside the stand. I asked him to check me carefully and tell me anything I did wrong.
"You just watch me and listen how I talk. You catch on." "Say," he said excitedly, "you got to do something about those hands."
Sunlight fell on them, causing the hairs to glint against the black skin.
"Oh, Lord," I groaned. "What'll I do?" "You got to shave him," he said, holding up his large fist to show his own hand had no hairs. "You got a razor?"
"Yes."
"Hurry up now, before somebody sees you." He became agitated and protective. "Down that alleyway there, clear to the end. You find a restroom, you can shave there right quick."
I grabbed my bag as he watched in agony to see that the way was clear. The shoe stand was in Skid Row, a street of ancient buildings with cheap rooming houses and bars. I hurried to the alley and walked down it into the gloom of a cluttered courtyard. A few Negroes, who could not enter the white bar, were served from the back. They stood around or sat at wooden tables, drinking. I saw a sign that read, "Gentlemen," and was almost at the door when several voices shouted,
"Hey, you can't go in there! Hey!"
I turned back toward them, astonished that even among Skid Row derelict joints, they had separate facilities. "Where do I go?" I asked.
"Clean on back there to the back," a large, drunk Negro said, pointing with a wild, swinging gesture that almost made him lose his balance.
I went another 50 feet down the alley and stepped into the wooden structure. It was oddly clean. I latched the door with a hook that scarcely held, smeared shaving cream on the backs of my hands, and shaved without water. Sterling nodded approval when I returned. He relaxed and smiled, the way one would after averting a terrible danger. His entire attitude of connivance was superbly exaggerated.
"Now there's not a hitch to you, my friend," he said. "Nobody'd ever guess."
An odd thing happened. Within a short time, he lapsed into familiarity, forgetting I was once white. He began to use the "we" form and to discuss our situation. The illusion of my Negro-ness took over so completely that I fell into the same pattern of talking and thinking. It was my first intimate glimpse. We were Negroes, and our concern was the white man and how to get along with him. How to hold our own and raise ourselves in his esteem without for one moment letting him think he had any God-given rights that we did not also have. A fine-looking middle-aged Negro woman, dressed in a white uniform, stepped out onto the sidewalk a few doors away and stared at me. Sterling nudged my ribs.
"You got that widow woman interested," he laughed. "You just watch. She'll find some reason to come down here before long."
I asked him who she was.
"She works there in the bar. Nice lady, too. She ain't going to rest till she finds out who you are."
I began to get thirsty and asked Sterling where I could find a drink.
"You got to plan ahead now," he said. "You can't do like you used to when you were a white man. You can't just walk in any place and ask for a drink or use a restroom. There's a Negro cafe over in the French Market about 2 blocks up. They got a fountain in there where you can drink. The nearest toilet's the one you just came from. But here, I got water."
He reached behind the shine stand and brought out a gallon lard can with wires looped through holes in each side to make a handle. A flake of ash floated on the water's surface. I upended the bucket and drank.
"Well, well, we are going to have company," Sterling said. "That nice widow woman's coming this way."
I glanced down the street. Past the metal upright shoe racks, I saw her walk gracefully toward us. She was carefully looking across the street. She ignored me and asked Sterling if he had any peanuts to sell.
"No, dear heart. Joe's out looking for some now. They're hard to find this time of year."
He spoke unctuously, as though he had no idea why she really came down, but all three of us knew he knew, and that we knew he knew. But the game had to be played. Then she turned and saw me, apparently for the first time. She looked startled, then delighted.
"Why, how do you do?"
she said, with a magnificent smile that illuminated not only her face, but the entire quarter. I bowed and returned the smile,
spontaneously, because the radiance of her expression took me by surprise. "Why, just fine. How do you do?"
"Fine," she bowed. "Nice to see you around."
I bowed again, confused. "I thank you, daughter." After an awkward, grin-filled pause, she turned to walk away.
"Well, I'll be seeing you," she sang out over her shoulder.
I looked dumbly at Sterling. He lifted his cap and scratched into the gray hairs of his head, his eyes wise and wide with amusement.
"Did you get that, eh?" he asked. "She liked you. You're in a fix now."
He burst out laughing.
"You hadn't counted on something like that, eh?"
"I sure hadn't," I said.
"She ain't no slut," he said. "She's a widow looking for a mate, and you're well-dressed. She ain't going to pass up a chance like that."
"Oh, Lord, this complicates things," I groaned. "Tell her I'm already married, will you?"
"Well, now, I don't know," he smiled. "That might just spoil the fun. I think I'll just tell her you're a widow man, a preacher visiting here in New Orleans. I feel like she's the kind that would love to be a preacher's wife."
"Look, you know I can't fiddle around with things like that. It'll be no fun for her when this project gets known and she finds out I'm a white man." Customers came. Whites, Negroes, and Latin Americans. Well-dressed tourists mingled with the derelicts of the quarter. When we shined their shoes, we talked. The whites, especially the tourists, had no reticence before us, and no shame since we were Negroes. Some wanted to know where they could find girls, wanted us to get Negro girls for them. We learned to spot these from the moment they sat down, for they were immediately friendly and treated us with the warmth and courtesy of equals. I mentioned this to Sterling.
"Yeah, when they want to sin, they're very democratic," he said.
Though not all, by any means, were so open about their purposes, all of them showed us how they felt about the Negro, the idea that we were people of such low morality that nothing could offend us. These men, young and old, however, were less offensive than the ones who treated us like machines, as though we had no human existence whatsoever. When they paid me, they looked as though I were a stone or a post. They looked and saw nothing. Sterling's partner, Joe, returned from his peanut hunt around 2. We explained my presence, and he welcomed me. Slender, middle-aged, though he looked young, Joe impressed me as a sharp but easygoing man. He lamented the lack of peanuts. Sterling told him many drunks had stopped by wanting to buy some, and that they could have made a pocketful of change had they been able to supply them. Joe began to cook our lunch on the sidewalk. He put paper and kindling from an orange crate into a gallon can and set it afire. When the flames had reduced to coals, he placed a bent coat hanger over the top as a grill and set a pan on to heat. He squatted and stirred with a spoon. I learned it was a mixture of corn, turnips, and rice, seasoned with thyme, bay leaf, and green peppers. Joe had cooked it at home the night before and brought it in a milk carton. When it was heated through, Joe served Sterling and me portions in cut-down milk cartons. He ate directly from the pan. It was good, despite the odor of rot that smoked up from it. Joe leaned over to me and pointed with his spoon to a man across the street.
"What's that wino?" he said. "He sit right there. He wants some of this food, but he won't come over till I tell him to."
Sitting on the curb across the street, the man stared feverishly at us, tensed, ready to come for the food when called. His eyes burned in his black face and his fists were doubled hard, as though he had to control himself from rushing over and grabbing the food. We ate slowly while the man stared. It was a strange game. We who were reduced to eating on the sidewalk were suddenly elevated in status by this man's misery. We were the aristocrats and he the beggar. It flattered us. We were superbly above him, and the comedy gave us a delusion of high self-respect. In a while, the magnanimity of the rich would complete the picture. We would feed our scraps to the poor. Our servings were ample. When we had eaten our fill, we scraped the remains from our cartons onto Joe's plate. The man trembled with expectation as Joe leisurely smoothed the food with the back of his spoon. Then, without looking at the wretch, Joe held out the pan. In a strangely kind tone of voice, he said,
"Okay, dog-ass, come get some food."
The man bolted across the street and grabbed the pan.
"If there'd been a car coming, he'd have been killed," Sterling remarked.
"Now listen, winehead. I want that pan back clean, you hear?" Joe said.
The beggar's gaze riveted to the food. His face crumpled as though he were about to weep, and he hurried into the alley without answering.
"He comes here every day. It's the same thing," Sterling said. "I guess he'd starve if it weren't for Joe."
Business died. We sat on boxes in the sunlight with our backs against the wall and watched traffic come and go in the French Market. I stared into the broken windows of a deserted stone building across the street. Sterling snored loudly and then awoke with a strangled snort. The beggar returned the pan, still wet from being washed. He handed it to Joe.
"Okay, wanhead," Joe said.
Without speaking, the man drifted away. I listened to the easy and usually obscene give and take between Joe and men of the quarter who passed the sidewalk.
"Hey, dog nuts, what's your hurry?"
"I got business, man."
"What business you got? Hey, where can I get some peanuts?"
"There ain't a peanut in this whole town. I've been all over."
"Me too," Joe said.
Odors of sweat, tobacco, coffee, and damp stone surrounded us, overladen always by the smell of fish and nearby salt water. I felt the wall warm against my back, making me drowsy. My first afternoon as a Negro was one of dragging hours and a certain contentment. After a while, Joe took a pocket Bible from the green serge army shirt he wore and began reading the Psalms to himself. His eyes drooped, but he formed the words silently with his lips. From force of long habit, whenever anyone walked by, he said,
"Shine,"
without raising his head from the page. Two pigeons flew down to the sidewalk at our feet. Joe tossed them some bread scraps. The sun sparked iridescence from their purple necks as they pecked. They provided us deep pleasure, an anodyne to the squalor and clutter of the street. Joe got stiffly up, dusted his seat, and ambled across to the fish market. When he returned, he had a sack of catfish heads and some green bananas. He told me the catfish heads were free, and that tomorrow we would have them for lunch. Catfish head stew over spaghetti. "It sounds good," I said, looking into the sack at dozens of glittering eyes. We wrapped the green bananas he had retrieved from the market waste bins in newspapers.
"They'll be ripe enough to eat in about 2 or 3 days," he said.
By 4 o'clock, the street was in shadow. Sunlight rimmed the buildings above us, and the air chilled rapidly. I decided to go find a room for the night. Sterling suggested I go to the Negro YMCA on Dryads, some distance across town.
"You better drink some water before you go," he said. "You might not find any before you get to Dryads."
I upended the bucket and saw the brass-colored circles at the bottom through the clear water. A bluish haze hung over the narrow streets of the French Quarter. The strong odor of roasting coffee overwhelmed all others. The aroma and the scene reminded me of my school days in France. This was like the old quarter of Tours, where they roasted coffee at the spice shops each afternoon. I emerged on Canal Street to a more modern scene, a crowded scene. I deliberately stopped many white men to ask the direction to Dryads in order to get their reaction. Invariably, they were courteous and helpful. On Dryads, the whites thinned, and I saw more and more Negroes in the street. A church came into view on my right, its tower rising up past a bridge heavy with traffic. A sign told me it was St. John the Baptist Catholic Church, one of the oldest in New Orleans. I mounted the steps and pulled open one of the heavy doors. Street noises were muffled with its closing. A faint fragrance of incense drifted to me in the deep silence. Soft, warm light filtered through magnificent stained glass windows in the church proper. Far to the front, I saw the dim figure of a Negro woman making the Stations of the Cross. A few men knelt here and there in the vast structure. Votive candles burned feebly in blue and red clusters before statues of St. Joseph and the Virgin Mary. I rested in a pew, leaning forward, my forehead against the bench in front, my hands in my lap. At home, my wife and children were probably having their evening baths, safe against the dusk and the cold. I thought of the house, so full of light and talk, and wondered what they would have for supper. Perhaps even now soup simmered on the kitchen stove. Opening my eyes, I looked down at my hands and saw each dark pore, each black wrinkle in the hairless flesh. How white by contrast the image came to me of my wife and children. Their faces, their flesh, simmered with whiteness, and they seemed so much a part of another life, so separated from me now that I felt consumed with loneliness. Rosary beads rattled against one of the pews, loud in the stillness. Perceptibly, the light dimmed through the windows, and the candles grew brighter. Dreading the thought of spending another night in some cheap hotel if I could not get a room at the Y, I considered hiding in the church and sleeping there in one of the pews. The idea appealed to me so strongly I had to cast it off by force. I got to my feet and walked out into a dusk shot with car lights rushing in each direction. The YMCA was filled to capacity, but the young man behind the desk suggested they had a list of nice homes where a man could rent a room. He kindly offered to telephone some of these. While waiting, I had a cup of coffee in the YMCA coffee shop, an attractive, modern place run by an elderly man who spoke with great elegance and courtesy. The young man at the desk came and told me he had arranged for a room in a private home next door to the Y. He assured me it was nice there, and that the widow who owned it was trustworthy in every way. I carried my bags next door and met Mrs. Davis, a middle-aged woman of great kindness. She led me upstairs to a back room that was spotlessly clean and comfortably furnished. We arranged for a brighter lamp so I could work. She told me she had only one other roomer, a quiet gentleman who worked nights, and whom I should probably never see. The kitchen was next to my room, and beyond that, the bathroom. I paid the $3 charge in advance, unpacked, and returned to the YMCA coffee shop, which turned out to be the meeting place of the city's important men. There I met a much more educated and affluent class, older men who brought me into the conversation. We sat around a U-shaped counter drinking coffee. The talk was focused exclusively on the problem and the forthcoming elections. The cafe proprietor introduced me to the Reverend A.L. Davis and one of his colleagues, Mr. Gale, a civic leader and bookstore owner, and a number of others. My feeling of disorientation diminished for a time. When asked what I did, I told them I was a writer, touring the South to make a study of conditions.
"Well, what do you think?"
the Reverend Mr. Davis asked. "I've only begun," I said, "but so far it's much better than I expected to find. I've been shown many courtesies by the whites."
We've made strides," he said, "but we've got to do a lot better. Then, too, New Orleans is more enlightened than any place else in the state or in the South."
"Why is that, I wonder?" I asked.
"Well, it's far more cosmopolitan, for one thing, and it's got a strong Catholic population," he said. "A white man can show you courtesies without fearing some neighbor will call him a nigger lover, like they do in other places."
"What do you see as our biggest problem, Mr. Griffin?" Mr. Gale asked.
"Lack of unity."
"That's it," said the elderly man who ran the cafe. "Until we as a race can learn to rise together, we'll never get anywhere. That's our trouble. We work against one another instead of together. Now you take dark Negroes like you, Mr. Griffin, and me," he went on. "We're old Uncle Toms to our people, no matter how much education and morals we've got. No, you have to be almost a mulatto, have your hair conked and all slicked out, and look like a Valentino,
Then the Negro will look up to you. You've got class. Isn't that a pitiful hero type?
And the white man knows that, Mr. Davis said.
Yes, the cafe owner continued. He utilizes this knowledge to flatter some of us, tell us we're above our people, not like most Negroes. We are so stupid we fall for it and work against our own. Why, if we'd work just half as hard to boost our race as we do to please whites whose attentions flatter us, we'd really get somewhere.
A handsome, mature man entered and was introduced as J.P. Guillory, an insurance agent. When the others had gone and the cafe was closing, Mr. Guillory told me he came often to the Y to play chess. He asked if I would join him in a game, but I had work to do.
"Your name is somehow familiar, Mr. Griffin," he said. "I'm an avid reader. I must have read something by you. What are the names of some of your books?"
I named them. His face blanked with astonishment.
"Why, I just started reading that. My lawyer friend lent it to me," he said.
He gazed at me, and I had no doubt he thought I was either a tremendous liar for claiming authorship of a white man's book, or that I was confessing something to him. "I promise you I wrote it," I said. "I can't tell you more, but read the book and the piece in last September's Reader's Digest, and you'll know who I really am." I returned to my room and wrote in my journal. My landlady lit the fire and brought a pitcher of drinking water for my nightstand. As I looked up to thank her, I saw the image in the large mirror of the wardrobe. Light gleamed from the elderly Negro's head as he looked up to talk to the Negro woman. The sense of shock returned. It was as though I were invisible in the room, observing a scene in which I had no part.